This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teck. We are continuing our weekly series on humanitarian development in the lead up to the International Day of Peace on September 21st. I have in the studio with me today Syed Al-Huzari, General Manager at Mercy Malaysia in charge of program development and operations. We're going to be discussing the do's and don'ts in a humanitarian response. Syed, if I can begin with this, is there a disconnect between what the public understands as humanitarian response and what aid workers actually do on the ground?
People usually, or the general public usually thinks aid worker, especially in Malaysia, we are volunteers, and then we do things out of our goodwill and free time. Whereas, actually, I mean, we have moved beyond that. So, aid workers nowadays, we are doing work, I mean, we are doing relief work. It is part of a professional, you know, professional career for some of us. We have like a specific, you know, understanding of the situation. We attend specific trainings in order for us to be qualified to do the things that we do. So we are no longer, I mean, doing things, I mean, because we are volunteering. Of course, I mean, there are still a lot of volunteers, I mean, who volunteers to do this kind of work. But we as Mercy Malaysia have made it an effort to train these volunteers, so that they are also, you know, professional volunteers when they join our missions, so on and so forth. Second thing, I think another misconception would be, you know, people tend to think that aid workers usually distribute food items or do healthcare. Yeah.
Those are the pictures normally that are blasted across newspapers
exactly,
or on the TV.
So actually, it's beyond that as well. We as aid worker, we have been trained to do things in a very systematic manner. When I say systematic, which means we have to do our own research before we go to any areas. Once we are there, we have to conduct our assessment on the situation, on who we wanted to assist, and we have to do our planning to prioritize, to develop plans on what we need to do, what is, you know, the most important things that we need to do next. And then only we will decide, you know, whether we need to do healthcare or food distribution or other things. So there are actually certain ways to do things. So we don't just go there and then do things randomly. The third thing, this is something that is more general. I mean, it's not only for the aid worker. The general public thinks that, you know, the donation that is given to any NGOs or non-profit organizations should only go to the victims of the disaster or crisis. Whereas, actually, in actual fact, I mean, there are a lot of things in that needs to be done before, I mean, it reaches the, you know, the victims. Think of it like a production pipeline, you know. You have to start from getting the supplies, and then you have to process it using machine, people and all, before it reaches, you know, the end user. So it's the same with doing humanitarian work. So we have to do a lot of planning. We have to do a lot of procurement. So we need like manpower. We need, you know, resources to do this before we actually, you know, send these items to the victims of the crisis or the disaster. So, yeah, I mean, that's the third one. And the fourth one, I think people tend to think that anyone can be an aid worker. It is true, anyone can be an aid worker, but of course, you need to have the right knowledge, the right skills. And the aid worker that we know nowadays, I mean, is usually divided into two types. One is the technical, you know, aid worker, usually the doctor, nurses, you know, the engineers. So they have this technical knowledge on to do their you know, their work. And then we have the non-technical one, who are usually more involved in management, logistics. They can do other things, you know.
Those who stay behind and make sure the office is up and running.
Yep, exactly. So basically, anyone can be an aid worker. But of course, I mean, you have to have, you know, the right knowledge, the right skills. And then you have to understand your capacity. Because at the end of the day, if you are, you know, contributing not within your capacity, I think you are, you will not give impact to the those you wanted to assist. Mm. So, yeah.
So this gap, is there any dangerous implications, or, you know, other than the fact that you have to keep informing or educating the public about the role an organization like Mercy plays?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. To a certain extent, I mean, there are like some danger, but I mean, we are more concerned on the efficiency of doing humanitarian work. You know, you can reach more people, you can do, you can have a better impact if you do things the right way, or, you know, through a certain system or procedures. Instead, I mean, if we are doing things randomly, I think we will lose the impact. You know. Instead of we can, you know, assist one community of 1,000 or 2,000 families from, you know, from the day they are they have been struck by that disaster until, you know, they reach to a recovery period. I mean, you can only do a bit, you know, during the immediate, you know, response. For, you know, for 10,000 families, so the impact is very little. If each agency can, you know, can start doing coordination, you know, understand their own capacity, and then try to focus their effort in the right manner, or, you know, based on the capacity that they have, actually we can we can have more impact. In Malaysia alone, I mean, there are a lot of NGO, you know, who is doing humanitarian work or development work in that case. So there are actually more things that we can do impactfully rather than just small things at one time. Yeah. So, but then it needs, you know, proper coordination. You need proper system, you know, in order to achieve, you know, such a result.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time after something terrible happens, that's when I suppose people's attention turn towards and humanitarian organization like Mercy Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And do you find that is, you have a very short window to communicate what you need to do and what they should do and what they shouldn't do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, disaster, I mean, doesn't happen very often. But of course, I mean, you have that time before any disaster, you know, struck, for you to do your advocacy work, and then for people, you know, to start rethink, you know, re-strategize how they're going to manage their operations if in case there's a disaster. For us in our organization, of course, I mean, we prepare even before any disaster struck. Of course, I mean, we have the development work ongoing on an annual basis, but we know that, you know, there's certain time where disaster is going to. We roughly know, you know, at the end of the year, you know, there's more disaster because of the monsoon season or for whatever reason. We try to prepare ourselves. It is also part and parcel of the business, whereby when something happens, we go and respond, and then other agencies or other NGOs also respond. And we found out that, you know, there are other people who is not following like certain standards system, or, I mean, doing things not the right way.
Mm. Let's talk about these do's and don'ts. What are some of the things that we should be doing? We start with the positive and then we'll...
Okay. If we look geographically, so when we respond to any country in that matter, we have to remember one thing. I mean, every country in the world, I mean, have their own sovereignty. So, which means, I mean, there are like system or there are like certain rules and regulations that we have to follow. For aid agencies, we have to know, do our research and understand what are these requirements by each countries. There are countries who are very open, who welcomes aid assistance. For example, countries like Sudan or Afghanistan, because they depend quite a lot on aid, foreign aid. So they have a very an existing mechanism how they're going to receive foreign aid. So you just have to know how to be registered, for example, and then how to do your work, I mean, from there. There are also countries we consider as close. You know, they don't welcome external or foreign aid. For example, like, I mean, it's not like they don't welcome, but I think it's more like they have a robust mechanism within the country. to manage any disasters or crises. For example, like India and China, they don't usually call for international assistance if there's a big disaster happening in that country.
Right.
And of course, I mean, there are also other countries which we never thought they're going to need assistance from outside. For example, like Japan. They have disasters like on annual basis, earthquake, and then sometimes a tsunami, flooding. But we never thought, because they are very advanced, that they will call for international assistance. The issue is, back in 2011, there were tsunami, and I think they themselves found out that they don't really have mechanism to receive foreign aid. So within the country, because they never expect that they will need to call for international assistance.
They have always been self-sufficient in being able to manage these situations.
Okay. So and then you have countries like Laos, which recently had a major flood in down south, but they also don't really have that mechanism to receive foreign aid. So but then they did call for for international assistance. So when the international when the foreign team arrive, they don't really have a mechanism how to manage them, where to send them, so on and so forth. But of course, being in ASEAN country, they ask assistance from the ASEAN, AHA team, which managed everything for them. So, there are mechanisms. So these are, like the do's when you go to another country.
Like in the case of Japan and Laos, was it because what happened was so unprecedented that they did not have the capacity to respond, or did they not have enough resources and they need more doctors and engineers, for example?
Well, in cases like Japan, I don't think they don't have enough resources. It's more likely when the other countries knows that Japan is in trouble, they are having like a major major disaster, they wanted to help. And they started to send items or things to Japan in order to relieve the burden. It's out of solidarity,
right.
With the country. But the thing is, it's just that Japan doesn't really have a mechanism to receive foreign aid at that particular point of time. I think majority of it was donation in kind. But of course, after 2011, they created a mechanism. We were in Japan back in 2015. During the WCDR, World Disaster Risk Reduction Conference. So, and then we saw, they shared that they had to come out with a new mechanism to receive foreign aid, just in case, if anything like this happens. Yeah. So it's not like, they were calling for international assistance, but then people wanted to contribute. So they need to have like a mechanism to receive, and also to make sure that everything is being distributed evenly and in an efficient manner. That's the thing.
Yeah. And so for countries that are more, I guess, close or have stricter requirements, like China and India, what happened in Kerala, for example, people everywhere are going to contribute anyway, regardless of whether they want it or not. What happens to all this donation, whether or not it's in kind or money?
Yep. So that's the other...
It relates to the don'ts, I guess.
Yeah, the don'ts. So you don't just jump the gun and then decide to collect clothes or donations in kind for you. To distribute, in disaster-stricken country. But we'll go into that after this. But of course, there are other ways. If NGOs or aid workers do their research, there are actually other ways for us to reach those who are in need in that particular country. Of course, if we go back to the Hinduian principle, humanity, we will assist, those who are in need whenever we found it. So, but then, there are actually other ways. We can help them by having partnership, with local organization. We partner with them. Of course, they will share, the information with us, and then we'll conduct, like a joint assessment. So, of course, since we are not registered in India, of course, we cannot do things officially. But then the partners could. So we just need to find, like, a reliable partner. That's why it's very important for you to have this networking, even before any disaster, happens.
Right.
So this networking actually will help you, if anything happens in that country. You don't really have to send your your own people first. You can rely on the partners to provide you, feed you with the information, and then, you know, start the emergency assistance. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is what we are doing in Mercy Malaysia. We are having this smart partnership and networking around the region. And then, because it is really helpful. Because at the end of the day, if anything happens, I mean, you want to be there first, or you want to reach there as soon as possible. But in some cases, you won't be able to do that, you know, because of the country's requirement. You need visa, things like that. Yeah. But you still need to provide assistance as soon as possible. So that's why by having the partners, I mean, they can, you know, they can start the response. At the same time, I mean, you can, you know, get yourself ready to assist them, provide them like some support in terms of planning, all those things.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't even have to go to international examples because floods happens in Malaysia too, and there are displacements and need that we need to attend to. Let's pause for a break and then we'll go through the don'ts when we come back. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Untek. My guest today is Syed Al-Hudzari of Mercy Malaysia. We're discussing the do's and don'ts in a humanitarian response. It's part of our weekly series in collaboration with Mercy Malaysia that commenced since the World Humanitarian Day on August 19th. We've covered the do's earlier, and I think one of the don'ts that I hear most frequently is that do not pack your old stuff and then set it off, you know, because more often than not, they're not going to need it, and you're just going to give agency or organizations like yourself more work to sift through what is required and what is not.
Yep.
So money is, or funds are always better.
Yep.
What are some of the other don'ts?
Okay, I mean, of course, I mean, what you said just now was very true. I mean, in donation in kind, I mean, it's not really encouraged, but it doesn't mean that we cannot, you know, provide donation in kind at all. You know, there are some cases or instances where we need to provide donation in kind. In places where, you know, everything has collapsed. You know, there's no way for you to, you know, to get supplies from inside the country. But it all goes back to the research that, you know, that you have conducted. So you have to do your own research. You have to understand culture, customs before you decide to, you know, to collect donation in kind. But donation in cash is, you know, is always better because it's very flexible. You can decide what to do with it because in a disaster situation, the needs always change. It's very dynamic. And you have to be ready for that. So if the needs suddenly change, if you are having cash, I mean, it's easier for you to, you know, to change the type of aid that you wanted to give. The other don't would be, don't be a hero, you know, when you go to respond to anywhere, any places. Don't be a hero, which means, I mean, you don't provide everything that you think is needed under the sun, you know. Just give random things to everyone that you see. People ask for clothes, you know. People ask for rice, and then you started to buy, you know, this small thing, and then you distribute. So you need to be more, again, I mean, systematic, and then to have like a proper way of determining the priority. Of course, we in Mercy Malaysia, I think even in some other NGOs in Malaysia, we have been trained on certain standards, what we call as sphere standard. It is a minimum requirement or minimum standards in emergency response. So
sphere, as in the,
yes,
the shape.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the sphere is the sphere standard. I mean, it teaches us, I mean, what are the most critical things that we should focus on whenever we respond to any emergency or disaster. For example, it will tell us that wash, water, sanitation and hygiene would be the first priority. Number two would be on food items. Number three would be on shelter and non-food items. Number four would be on healthcare, which means if you are the first to arrive in any disaster-stricken place, and you found out that, I mean, nobody is there. So you should focus, number one, in providing them with water instead of doing healthcare. So this is how we determine and prioritize, you know, our response. Yeah. So my advice on the don'ts, don't just do everything under the sun. Plan properly and then prioritize, because you have to understand what are the needs, what are the gaps, and then what is your own capacity, you know, in managing the response. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, you can, you know, you can plan what is the best way or what is the most impactful things that you can do. Because at the end of the day, the gaps will always be covered by other agencies. We shouldn't think that, you know, we are the only one there. So that's why we need to attend coordination meetings, you know, to share, I mean, what we are doing and also to get input from others what they are doing so that, you know, we are not doing the same thing as others. Mm. Again, I mean, it should be a more targeted approach whereby you target like certain community or certain number based on your capacity rather than doing it randomly.
Mm. Yep. Most of the time, less is more for a layperson who want very desperately to contribute or do something. And I think you are a great example of how you don't always have to be an action hero on the front lines in order to do good, right? Because what you do is very important as well in keeping operations up and running as general manager and in charge of program development and operations. Do you go on a few missions too?
I do go to field missions. So of course, I mean, when I started with Mercy Malaysia, I mean, I was a program officer. So my job was to, you know, to manage all this project from end to end. But nowadays, I mean, I'm involved mainly in terms of planning. So I still go to missions and then meet up with the stakeholders on the ground, either the government or our partners, and then, you know, try to solve certain issues or come out to certain agreement so that, you know, the project can be implemented smoothly on the ground, you know, negotiating access, things like that, yeah.
You've been with Mercy for more than 10 years now.
Yeah. Yeah,
right out of a university, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Yeah. How did that happen?
So this is something that, you know, that I've always been, I mean, something that I've always and have an interest in. I've been doing, you know, community service work, I mean, during my uni years. So it's not something that is unfamiliar to me. So when I finish studying, you know, I got the offer, you know, to join Mercy Malaysia.
What do you think is the tipping point for, you know, in countries around the world with a developed or mature nonprofit sector? What happens, or at what point do the population view this sector as a professional sector rather than a voluntary vocation?
I think in any countries, it should start with the policy, you know, policy implemented by the government. If, you know, if we have a stronger policy in managing non-profit organization or NGO, non-government organization, I mean, that would be one step forward for NGO by having like certain standard. I mean, NGO needs to follow certain standard or have certain standard. All NGO needs to have, you know, like to fulfill some due diligence. So it needs to start from the policymakers. So if the policymakers can, you know, can improve on this law, you know, the Society Act, I think it would be one of the way how this the NGO can be seen as a professional entity or, you know, professional career in Malaysia. There are countries who, you know, who already done this, including UK. The Charity Commission, they have like a very robust, you know, mechanism in monitoring all the NGOs there. They can ask any NGO to, you know, to be closed. So they have that mechanism because you know, the system that they have is very robust. They monitor as well the, you know, where the financial, I mean, where the money is going to. Europe, I mean, they are very, very advanced on this. But in ASEAN as well, countries like Indonesia have, you know, a much better system in managing the NGO. You know, I've been there even recently, a couple of weeks back, I was in Jakarta talking to some NGO friend. So, I mean, they were telling that, okay, in order for us to, you know, become an NGO, so we have to oblige to like either this act or that act. So, I mean, it's very systematic. And most of the NGO, at least the one that I've met in Indonesia, I mean, they are quite self-sustaining, you know, because of the, you know, because of the policies that they have, which can turn them into a very sustainable organization. They don't really have to, you know, to appeal for funding every time they want to respond. They can always, you know, they have like a reserve funds that they can use first. while they wait for the appeal to come in. So, you know, by having a proper policy, I mean, it can really help to, you know, improve the overall status of an NGO. Of course, there are other things that, I mean, can be done through advocacy work, you know. New NGOs can also, you know, partner with experienced NGO. Most important thing, I mean, to attend or invest in trainings and improve skills. So, I mean, when I first joined Mercy Malaysia, I mean, there's not much training offered in this field. But after 10 years, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, trainings in terms of disaster management, humanitarian action, how to do project management offered in Malaysia itself. So the opportunity, I mean, was not present 10 years back, but now it's here. So I think organizations can take this opportunity, you know, to learn and then to improve their skills in order for them to, you know, to become a professional organization. Yeah. You know, it should not be just a voluntary organization.
Not a hobby, yeah. Do you find the management aspect of this work rewarding, or do you find going out on field missions more rewarding?
Of course, going to missions, as majority of people who join Mercy Malaysia, I mean, that would be the first thing that they can think of. Yeah, they want to go to missions. When I first joined, it's not something that I really put at the back of my head. I mean, going to missions, but then, I mean, I have to do it because, but I don't have like any reservation of going to other countries. But then when I joined Mercy Malaysia, I mean, that is the responsibility that I have to take. So, I mean, I do it. So, I do it out of my responsibility towards, you know, towards the work that I'm doing. So, I mean, there's some, you know, satisfaction in there as well. But, of course, I mean, at the end of the day, it's about, you know, completing your job, you know, delivering what needs to be delivered. That is the most satisfied things that you can see. You know, you plan for something, you go for an assessment, you plan for something, and then after 1 week or after, you know, after a couple of months sometimes, you know, then your health center is up and the doctors is already started to provide services to the patients. You know, that's something that is very satisfying, I mean, for me, you know, to see people who, you know, who we wanted them to get the assistance, I mean, do really get the assistance that we offered. So yeah.
Syed Ahud Zarin, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you. Yeah.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.